Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Making a place a more vibrant and more appealing place to live is a top concern for cities and towns of all sizes. But urban planning professor Nan Ellen says too much time is spent focusing on shortcomings. Every community, she says, can build on its strengths. And in a new book, she details how. Today on the program, Nan Ellen joins us to talk about case studies and tips presented in her new book, Good Urbanism: 6 Steps to Creating Prosperous Places. Nan Ellen is a professor and chair of the Department of City and Metropolitan Planning at the University of Utah. She's the author of a couple of books, Integral Urbanism and Postmodern Urbanism. She was the driving force behind Canalscape, an initiative to create vital urban hubs where canals meet streets throughout metropolitan Phoenix. And again, her latest book is titled Good Urbanism. And Professor Nan Ellen joins me in studio. Professor Ellen, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's great to be here.
Later on in the program, getting away from it all, we'll get some tips for the small business owner or entrepreneur wanting to take a vacation. But first, good urbanism. What do you like about your neighborhood or city? What works in your town? And what do you admire in other communities? You can join our conversation if you like. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Nan Ellen, it's human nature to focus on what's wrong, what's bad, the deficits that we see as a way to point toward a better solution. But you say that this is the wrong approach when it comes to urban planning. Why?
That's right. If we focus on the deficits, we tend to imagine that, spend our times complaining, whining, pointing the finger. And I think it's that doesn't get a whole lot accomplished. Instead, if we take responsibility and focus on the strengths, we can move forward.
What got you thinking about not just solutions, but how we approach improving cities and towns?
Well, I started to realize that as an urbanist, I started to realize that people speak with great emotion about the places they live. You hear people, all of us, we say, "I love that city. I love that neighborhood. I love that house." Conversely, people use the word hate a lot. "I hate that city. I hate that neighborhood. I hate that house." So I started thinking, what is it that makes people proclaim their love for a place? And I started to realize that when people say, "I love a place," it's because they feel connected when they're there. They feel a connection maybe with themselves, maybe with other people, maybe with nature, maybe with the past, perhaps with the future, maybe with a higher being. And conversely, when they say they hate, it's because they feel disconnected. So it became my task to figure out not just how we can make places livable. We talk about that a lot, livable places, but also lovable places. And in order to do that, you need to foster these connections. So I started to realize it wasn't just about thinking about a product, but also thinking about a process and getting people involved from the beginning to envision and take ownership of their places.
There are very few places where it's just a blank slate. You know, you can go crazy with an environment that has not been touched yet. We live in places where there are pockets that need some attention, need some help. How do you create the love in a place where maybe it's been neglected for many years and you don't immediately feel a connection? How do you develop a connection with a place that, you know, doesn't have much to offer?
A place that you don't typically think of as lovable.
Right.
Well, you know, if you ask people who live in that place or maybe people who work there, if you say to them, you start asking them questions like, you know, "Why are you here?" Or you could say, "What do you like about it or love about it?" But if it's not a great place, you might just say, "Why are you here? Why did you choose to live here?" Or, and they will start coming up. Everybody will start coming up with things that they appreciate about their place. And they might start talking about the bad things, and that's fine. And you let them talk about all of those bad things. And you kind of steer them back to what do you appreciate. And they might say something like, "Oh, we have beautiful views and we have great neighbors." And they'll start going on and on. And when that happens, you reframe the conversation. And when you reframe the conversation, people's whole attitude changes. And they go from being sort of depressed and demoralized, which is what happens if you ask them about, what's wrong with this place? What don't you like about this place? And they start to become creative. When people talk about what they love, they are rendered naturally creative, and they start naturally thinking about solutions to those things that are problems. So what happens in this process is that things that are considered problems often become reconfigured to seem to be opportunities. Mm.
Speaking with Nan Ellen, she's a professor and chair of the Department of City and Metropolitan Planning at the University of Utah. Her new book is titled Good Urbanism. And if you'd like to join us, we're talking about cities and improving cities and the process of improving cities. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. This seems to be a very introspective approach and internal. I mean, is this a fundamental shift in urban planning, searching out a community's strengths rather than what a place lacks?
It is happening, and it is a shift. We did, for many years, we focused on problems. And now you see, and I showcase about 10 examples in the book of places that are actually doing this. This is happening. I actually think it's happening beyond urban planning as well. I think it's happening in society generally, that we're shifting from a focus on deficits to thinking about assets and strengths and the gifts that are already there and building on those.
You don't seem to have a very high opinion of outsiders coming in and imposing something on a community. And I'm thinking of consultants who brand a place, or the so-called starchitects, the architects who come in and do an amazing project, and then they leave town as quickly as they can.
I don't have a problem with people coming in from elsewhere, starchitects or consultants, as long as they follow this process. I think if we were to say that we should only have local people doing everything, that would be like saying we should only have books by local authors in our library, and that wouldn't be great. But I do think that the right process, whether they're people who are local or whether they're people from elsewhere coming in, they should begin by really consulting with the local experts who are the people who live here.
So involving everyday members of the public, people who live here, who work in a certain place, asking for their opinions. That's important.
Absolutely. And we do, I mean, that's been discussed for many, many years, the importance of community engagement. Unfortunately, that process has not been accomplished very well. Usually it's very quick, and even the practitioners themselves call it CYB, cover your butt, community engagement sometimes. And they say, we ask people, and they do it in a not meaningful way. And this is a process that I outline through the six steps that accomplishes this, what a lot of people have been calling these days co-creation. And this involves not a top-down process with either the architect or the planner or the politicians telling people what's going to happen. But neither is it a bottom-up process. It's not completely grassroots. It's both at the same time. So I call it a sideways process. You just rotate the pyramid on its side. And everybody gets involved at the beginning. You bring in as many people as you can as quickly as possible, and you co-create.
Mm. Well, the subtitle to your book is Six Steps to Creating Prosperous Places. We'll get to them in detail as we go, but outline for us these six steps to creating a prosperous place.
Sure. The first step is that introspective one you mentioned, and that's prospecting. And that's basically, it's a metaphor for prospecting for gold. It's figuring out what those riches are, what those gems are that already exist in the place. You might have to dig down a little bit to find them, but identifying them. And then polishing takes that raw piece of gold and it polishes it. It takes it to the next level, so it's not so raw anymore. Proposing takes that polished piece of gold and it turns it into something specific. That's a proposal. And at the next stage, we want to let people know about it, people who haven't already been involved in the process. So we're continuing the co-creation, which actually begins at the very beginning with prospecting. We're continuing at this point and letting more people know through effective communication, all different kinds of communication. We also, around this time, want to test it out and prototype it. So maybe a little implementation of it somewhere to see how it's working. And also, that's another form of promoting. And finally, the sixth step is to present it. I mean, we don't stay with our projects our whole lives. It's like raising a child and then allowing them to go off and be independent on their own. So these projects, at some point, we present them over to communities. So we start with the gifts and we end with a gift, with presenting it, a present to others. So the process is a kind of a spiral, and it's an economy of gifts. We start with gifts and we end with gifts.
Mm. How long does this take? To remake a place.
Yeah. Okay. This can be applied at any scale. So it can be applied to an individual building. It could be applied to a neighborhood, a region, whatever. So obviously it would depend on the project at hand. It's very case specific.
We're speaking with Nan Ellen. She's a professor and chair of the Department of City and Metropolitan Planning at the University of Utah. Her new book is titled Good Urbanism, Six Steps to Creating Prosperous Places. And we're talking about transforming communities. And if you've got a favorite part of town, can you figure out why it's so appealing? This idea that communities should identify and use their strengths as a guide to rehabbing rundown areas. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. We'll have more after a break. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. City leaders are always trying to figure out just what will improve a rundown part of town, and frequently the discussion turns negative, pointing out all of the faults of a place. But that fault finding often ends up in spinning wheels. And in a new book, urban planning professor Nan Ellen says there's a better way. Today on the program, we're talking about what she calls good urbanism. She is a professor and chair of the Department of City and Metropolitan Planning at the University of Utah, and her latest book is Good Urbanism, Six Steps to Creating Prosperous Places. If you'd like to join our conversation, why do you think some communities are so appealing and some are so ho-hum at best and blighted at worst? What elements do you think makes a city livable and lovable? You can join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We're talking about good urbanism. Professor Ellen, give us some examples of what you consider good urbanism. In my introduction, I mentioned that you were a crucial part of a project called Canalscape in Phoenix. Describe this project for us.
That's right. Canalscape takes these canals that are the infrastructure for the region of Phoenix, and they're treated as back alleys currently to a large extent. And it says, you know, instead of back alleys, they should be our front doors. These are not a liability. These are not a problem. These are an opportunity. And we think of Venice and other canal cities. And I looked at these other canal cities, and Phoenix has more canals than they do. It has actually more canal miles than Venice and Amsterdam put together.
Oh, my goodness.
And yet no one thinks of Phoenix as a canal city. So I said, let's take not the entire length of the canals, because they're huge and there's it wouldn't be practical to do that. But the areas where the canals meet major arterials, let's take those areas and convert them into vital urban hubs. And so I started with the prospecting, which was the first part of the prospecting I call me search, when you just don't talk to anyone. You just ask yourself what should happen here. And I had been walking the canals for a long time, imagining what this could be. And I wrote an article for the Arizona Republic and got tremendous feedback from people all ages and ethnicities and very diverse groups saying, we need to do this. And so I moved forward onto the next stage, and I spiraled up. And it was really through doing Canalscape that I learned about the six steps and how other people could do this. And so after I did it myself, I brought students in. And that's the second part of prospecting, which is we search. So I go from me search to we search. And at the same time we start the we search, we start research. Mm. And research is really looking into all the other canal cities and looking into the sites and the history and the culture of the place. And then we move on to make these proposals, and then we promote, prototype, and finally present.
What were some of the lessons besides the six steps from this project that you that really cemented the way you are thinking about city planning these days?
Very early on in that process, after I'd written the first article, the editorial board of the Arizona Republic thought that this was a project they wanted to support, and they brought together leaders from the city to their editorial boardroom to talk about it. And the people who ran the utilities, who ran the canals essentially, who managed them, called SRP, the Salt River Project, came in and they basically said, no, no, no. And at the end of the meeting, I said to the person who organized it, Phil Boas from the Arizona Republic, I said, wow, that was a horrible meeting. And he said, no, that was a great meeting. And I learned from him, actually, that that kind of blockage that you face is a lesson. And so you don't see that as a problem. You see that as a teaching tool. They're teaching me what was not good about the proposal. And so I had to go back and refine it. And that's why you bring people in right at the beginning, because there may be issues with your proposal. And so they taught me in this case that I needed to be really careful about talking about affecting the water in any way, or even affecting the right-of-ways, the area right along it, because they use that for delivery of water and delivery of electricity, which is really important.
Yes.
And so I wanted to respect this important work that they did. I refined the proposal, came back, not touching the water, not touching the right-of-ways, just working on the private property adjacent to the right-of-ways. And then they got on board and they became big supporters.
Mm. In some ways, what you're describing is, I believe, what you refer in the book as the ego system versus the ecosystem. And a lot of times people, when they are promoting an idea on how to improve a community, it becomes all about them instead of about the larger we.
Absolutely. And I talk with my students a lot about this. I mean, it's hard for everyone. It's hard for me, too. We get caught up in these ideas that we think are so great, you know, our ideas. And when people don't like them, we have a tendency to say, oh, well, they just don't get it. Mm. They don't understand how brilliant my idea is. And you know, I work with this with my students because they get wedded to ideas. And we do the co-creation. We bring other people in. And, you know, they're hurt and offended when people don't like their ideas and they want to stick to their ideas. And we talk about shifting from the ego system to the ecosystem. And the ecosystem includes everyone and everything. And so to see that feedback, of course, you're kind of, you know, dismayed at first. But you need to take that in and say, you know, they're giving me a gift by helping me out and letting me know they don't like it for one reason or another. And I need to go back to the drawing board and work that out a little bit more.
Hmm. Do you think that that has, the ego becomes a barrier to progress sometimes? I mean, we do need to set aside personal agendas for a greater good.
Well, it's not a trade-off so much. I do believe that we end up with a win-win situation when we engage in this process. Because if you stick to your idea and people don't like it, it's never going to be implemented usually. So good urbanism is really about matching good ideas to resources. And as you work with these people along the way, what you're doing when you engage in sideways urbanism and co-creation is that you're getting these ideas that improve your project along the way, but you're also getting resources, because these are the people who you're going to get resources from, and they feel that it's their project too. They are becoming owners of this project as you engage in this process along the way.
Speaking with Nan Ellen, professor and chair of the Department of City and Metropolitan Planning at the University of Utah, her new book, Good Urbanism, Six Steps to Creating Prosperous Places. And if you'd like to join us, we're talking about city planning, what makes communities so appealing or not so appealing. You can join us at 801-355-TALK is our number. Closer to home, you focus on Envision Utah. What I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with Envision Utah, but explain why you think that this is an example of what good urbanism can do.
I think Envision Utah is very highly regarded amongst planners actually around the world. I'm not sure if people in Utah know that. Because it does this process so well. It's not invested in ego. It's not one person's idea. Envision Utah is extremely proficient at bringing people together to find out what they think is already working in the place. That's the prospecting. And then to say, how can we build on those strengths to make our place even better? They're also extremely proficient at promoting it through all different kinds of media, and in the process getting more feedback to refine the idea and then to rally the resources to implement those ideas.
Do you think that this is a recipe that other areas are copying?
Well, that's a great question. I know that planners have been studying it, and I know that other cities have been trying to emulate it. I cannot think of other examples that are as good as Envision Utah. Maybe they exist, but Envision Utah is still an exemplar.
It's one thing to have this vision, and you previously mentioned that you have to have a path to success, a way to get people behind the idea, and then to rally the resources around an idea in order to make it a reality. How do you do that?
Well, it's not so much getting them to believe in your vision as the vision comes from them as well. So they're engaged from the beginning. They take ownership. They start to see how it can affect them in a daily way. And when that happens, instead of becoming that sort of demoralized, sitting back, allowing the experts to do it and then pointing the fingers at the experts and saying they didn't do a good job. Everybody works from their own strengths. And at this point, people are building on their own strengths in order that they can build on the strengths of places. And obviously, when you got more people involved, lending their own talents and skills and resources, things happen more and they happen more effectively.
You know that preservation is an important part of good urbanism. Describe why.
Yeah. Well, when you first start with what you value instead of starting with what you don't have, when you think about all of those things you do have that you love, you say, let's make sure we protect these. That's the first step. And then you start thinking, well, you know, we have these things that could be good, but they're not quite good. And so then you say, well, these things that are underperforming, let's enhance those. And so you start with protecting what you love. Then you move on to enhancing what's underperforming. And then finally you say, okay, what don't we have at all that we'd like to add? So it's protect, enhance, and add. Those are the steps. Typically, planning does not do that. I mean, this sounds pretty obvious and simple, but typically planning does not do that. It comes in and it says to people, so what don't you have, and what do you want that you don't have? And people will say, I'll give you an example from Phoenix. People brought in consultants to say, we need a new stadium, baseball stadium, but we don't know where to put it. Could you help us identify a location? So they came in with, we need to find a location for the baseball stadium. They didn't say, what do you have here that you already love? They said, what do you need? And so they ended up identifying the Arts District is a great location for the stadium, which meant that the Arts District was obliterated. Okay, so they didn't start by protecting what they loved. When you start with what do you want, what are you missing that you want, then you might end up with this stadium, but you lose something that you loved.
What about open space? Mm-hmm. How does that fit into good urbanism?
Well, if you ask communities what they love, they will always tell you that they love their open space. And there's all kinds of open space. There's open space for recreation. There's open space that's natural preserves. And they will always talk about that as very important part. Open space is critical to health and well-being and to good urbanism. So if you ask people, just come in and basically say, what do you love? The open space will come up. And then you take that protect, enhance, add process and you protect everything they say that they love. Then you go to the enhance and they'll say, well, we have an open space over here and we have one over here, but it'd be really nice to connect them. And so you enhance and you create a connected open space system. And then they'll say, and over in this part of town, we have no open space, and we really want some. And that's where you add.
Talk about the High Line in New York City. So I don't know if anyone would have said that they loved the elevated railway mm-hmm. that ran through their neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and yet it was transformed into a new use. It's open space. It's a parkway. Describe the High Line project for us, but what you see as elements of good urbanism in that project.
The High Line is a great example of good urbanism. This is a case where it was seen as a liability, and then people came along and said, a large group of people came along and said, wait a minute, that's not a problem, that's an opportunity. And they painted this picture through co-creation. They painted this picture, so they did prospect, they did polish. Propose is painting the picture of what it could be. And then they brought people on to support it. So they promoted the concept in many ways, and then they began to prototype it, and now the High Line is growing and growing and is considered to be one of the absolute greatest amenities of New York City. They themselves were actually inspired by a High Line in Paris that's called the Promenade Plantée and another elevated viaduct and that was converted into a linear park over the city. And now cities from all over the world, every single day, there are people from all over the world who are sent to the High Line to learn from it and bring it back to their abandoned infrastructures in their cities. Mm.
Can you bring it back to us here in Salt Lake City or in the Valley? Are there communities where you see some really exciting things going on when it comes to using good urbanism principles?
Well, actually, when I first arrived here a little over 2 years ago, my very first semester with my students, I wanted to learn about the assets of Salt Lake City and figure out how we could build on them. So we did a huge asset inventory. We spent a month and have layers and layers of GIS data. And we ended up working very closely with the city and the community to turn the abandoned railroad just by 900 South, just south of 900 South, into something like the High Line, except it's on the ground. So we were initially going to call it the Low Line. We thought that's probably not a great idea. And then my students brainstormed and they came up with the idea to call it the Nine Line. So inspired by the High Line and south of Nine South, the Nine Line. And we spent the rest of the semester developing this proposal to convert it into the Nine Line. The idea was that it would connect 9th and 9th West with 9th and 9th East. The railroad doesn't go that far, but we wanted it to veer off from the railroad and then turn into a bike path along 9 South and at certain areas where there are empty lots right now to convert those into vital hubs, kind of like canalscape. And we presented it to the city. As I said, we co-created with them from the beginning and with the communities along the High Line. We co-created. We got their feedback, which was extremely, extremely important. We could not have done it without them. And by the end, they really liked the proposal, and they went ahead and they allocated resources, and they started to actually build the Nine Line now.
Well, can we see it?
Yeah, it's there.
I totally need to check this out.
Yeah, there's an area of the railroad that's been asphalted into a path, and you can see little signs along it that say the Nine Line, and it has our logo. And you can also get information about it on our website, the slcworkshop.com, and you look under projects and click on the Nine Line, and you can get more information about it. And there's also a little place on there to provide us with feedback. So we continue the co-creation through our website.
When will it be finished?
I don't know. You'll have to ask the city about that. But we're continuing to work on that.
Very good. It's one thing to implement good urbanism principles at a city level. Can you do it at a regional level? Can you incorporate these ideas beyond one city's borders? And I guess I'm thinking primarily of the Salt Lake Valley.
Well, the interesting thing about good urbanism is it does not correspond to jurisdictions because it's about people, and people cross jurisdictions. Envision Utah is a great example. The work that they've done has been very regional and statewide in some cases. The key is to get the co-creation going. And as you get people in that area, then you will be affecting that region, that larger region.
Would you say that a lot of city planners are open to these ideas? Are they trained in good urbanism principles?
It's happening independently. I think it's a generational thing. So I think that this current generation is very natural to shift from deficits to assets, to think about the gifts that are already here. And I think there's a technology correlate to that. I think their ability to use social media to get any information they need empowers them from a very young age. And so they don't think in this top-down hierarchy to begin with. They think more as a circle. And if you think more as a circle or a spiral, you naturally engage others. Many of my students have talked about a shift away from so that used to be that everybody wanted to move to the great cities, New York and San Francisco, and now they feel that they can make a great place right here. And partly because they can easily travel and get information about these other places if they want access to them, but they also feel that they have the ability to get access information and to make changes right here. And they also feel that it's much more fulfilling to create a great place than to go to a place that's already been created. They want to engage in that co-creation.
You write in the book that this is an exciting historical moment, and that you're seeing some really cool projects, you know, crop up all around the country when it comes to good urbanism principles. You seem very optimistic about the future of urban planning.
I am, and I think it's partly because I teach, so I've seen, and I've been teaching for 25 years, I've seen the shift in the generations. I'm always asking them, what do they think, and what's going on? And I have seen a tremendous shift. And the period, 1960s, 70s, 80s, or let's go back to the 50s maybe, were kind of dark decades in urban planning. They were very technical. They were very much about how to get from point A to point B as quickly as possible. And now we're thinking, how can we enjoy the journey between point A and point B? So there's been a real shift in urban planning, urban design. And in this book, what I'm trying to do is to explain that in very basic terms. What is this shift that's going on? What characterizes it? And that's the six steps along the path toward prosperity. And then if you are wanting to accelerate your own shift in your practices, whether you're architect, planner, urban designer, real estate developer, or anything, or in your lives, because this can apply to anything, not just urban design, you could learn about how to follow the six steps and accelerate your shift from focusing on deficits to focusing on gifts.
So the target audience, not necessarily urban planners.
Right. Maybe I'm trying to speak to too many people and not speaking to anyone. I've been afraid of that the whole time I was writing the book. But I think I intended this to be for everyone. So if you want to contribute to improving the places you live, and you come from any walk of life, any profession, I think that you could learn about how to follow the six steps and to be effective in this way.
Dr. Nan Ellen, professor and chair of the Department of City and Metropolitan Planning at the University of Utah. Her latest book, Good Urbanism, Six Steps to Creating Prosperous Places. And Professor Ellen, thanks so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Coming up next, ways to help entrepreneurs take a holiday. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City.